The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Mr. Flurry is experiencing a part of the subject I plan on talking about a bit later in today's program. He's experiencing that firsthand. He is in London. I think he's got to go into the American Embassy for some paperwork. And it is absolute chaos in there today. The rail drivers are on strike. The vast majority of the London Underground, the Tube, the railways underground that so many people rely on, are mostly closed. Buses are pretty chaotic with very long queues. Roads are in chaos. One major train station was just evacuated. They had a few trains running, and so lots of people were queuing to try and get on these few trains that were going, and it became so dangerously overcrowded that they had to evacuate. So that's what Mr. Flurry is out in today. Actually, we do have a quick clip that we grabbed from the news just right before we launched, because obviously this is something that is just happening. We're not sure on the quality, but we'll try giving that a play for you now.
I mean, I don't really, to be honest, I don't know why they're striking, but I know it's affected me because I'm on probation at work, so I'm trying to be on time every day and now I'm late.
No, I don't support it because although I'm only affected by a short while, I think others are affected by a lot longer and they don't realise how much it affects people's work times.
It's probably the longest queue I've been ever in the last few years I've been here. So, yeah, it's not been a great experience, but at least good to see people are in a good mood.
It's one we grabbed from the BBC's website. You heard that gentleman there saying the longest queue he's ever been in. Hopefully it's not too bad for Mr. Flurry. He was driving in and so shouldn't be affected too much by the trains, and the roads were pretty bad at the rush hour, but it looks like they've cleared up now, so we'll have to wait for him to get back and see how that goes. But this does lead in nicely to what I want to talk about for most of the time today. Are we in for more kind of this strife, this unrest, even social unrest? Well, I'd like to talk today about technology and social unrest. Are we on the cusp of radical technological developments that could really just accentuate the social unrest that we're doing, help that build and build, cause more of these kind of strikes, etc. as well, that really impact the economy? Is technology already playing a role? That's what I'd like to get to in a few minutes. But first, there was just one article I wanted to share from looking over the news this morning. It's an article that really does get to the core of a lot of what America's foreign where America's foreign policy has been going wrong under Mr. Obama, and even mistakes that just a lot of commentators, media, even the general public make. This article is called "Obama's Foreign Policy Was Error After Error" by George F. Will in the Washington Post, and he starts that article by quoting Mr. Obama, who recently said that almost every country on earth sees America as stronger and more respected today than they did 8 years ago. Now, I think that's very clearly not true, but why? What are the mistakes? What are the mistakes at the root of the problems that has led America to here? Well, there are a number of reasons, but one is a core assumption shared by Mr. Obama and all of his team. And George F. Will talks about this in his article, and he writes that progressives, you know, like Mr. Obama and his team, are disposed to believe that peace among nations is natural and spontaneous, or it would be if other nations would cleanse their minds of their superstitions that prevent them from recognizing the universal validity and demonstrable utility of American principles. And then he writes, the fact that the world is more disorderly and less lawful than when Mr. Obama became president is less his fault than the fault of something about which progressives are skeptical, the powerful, unchanging human nature. Humans are, as Job knew, born into trouble as the sparks fly upwards. They are desirous and competitive and hence prone to conflict. And so this idea, this concept of human nature and this truth that human nature is evil, is prone to conflict, as George Will writes here, is something that's right at the heart of our international relations class at Herbert W. Armstrong College. Just the very second lecture of the class this year, Mr. McDonald came and gave that as a guest lecture, focusing on human nature because it is so foundational. And actually, this does in some ways, we'll come back to some of this as we talk about our main subject of social unrest a bit later as well. But this is just a quote from the textbook that we use for international relations here, Morgenthau's Politics Among Nations, and it writes, "The tendency to dominate in particular is an element of all human associations, from the family through fraternal and professional associations and local political organizations to the state." And this is one of the big things Morgenthau gets right. He writes, "The drives to live, to propagate, and to dominate are common to all men. This idea that man by nature is competitive, seeks to dominate." And Morgenthau basically says, well, look at all of history. We see that throughout all of history. Man has always been competing against man, nation against nation. And he says we see it in every level of society. We see competition. We see get. Man struggling to dominate. You see that in families. So often families are a site of competition, of who's going to get their own way. You see it within social groups. You see it in businesses. It's a competition to rise to the top. For individuals competing for power within companies, companies competing for power within each other. You see it in politics, in local politics, in national politics, competition for power. And he basically says, well, why wouldn't you see it on the international scene between nations? But as George Will writes in that article, that's one of the problems with progressive leaders and writers and thinkers is their belief that peace is just the natural state of things, and that if you get rid of some of these outmoded social institutions, then, well, that peace will just be the natural result because, as they see it, human nature just wants to live at peace and is basically good. And that understanding is really at the heart of the reason why Morgenthau, I think it goes all the way back to Ambassador College, has been the textbook for the international relations class, along with the Bible and certain other literature and other books. We use bits from other books as well, but Morgenthau has been one of the main textbooks. You know, he does get some things wrong, but this foundation he gets absolutely right. And I did really like this George Will article because it just illustrates the relevance and importance of a biblically based understanding of human nature to understanding world events. And as Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart of man is deceitful and desperately wicked. And this article just really brings out the importance of understanding that to understanding what you see in the world. It's something that very clearly demonstrates the Bible's relevance to world events. And we saw in that quote, even he went back and even and referenced Job. A couple of other quotes from that article. It says, in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea, Secretary of State John F. Kerry was disappointed with Putin, saying, more in sorrow than in anger, you just don't in the 21st century behave in 19th century fashion. If you do, you place yourselves on, in one of Mr. Obama's favorite phrases, the wrong side of history. And then Will continues, make that history with a capital H, which in the progressives' lexicon is a proper noun, an autonomous thing with a mind or at least a logic of its own. Kerry's reprimand of Putin expressed a progressive certitude about progress. The passage of time should ineludibly improve the component of nations, or the comportment of nations. Which is why in 1911, the renowned 11th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, sounds like what they should have called the children's version of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. The Encyclopaedia Britannica, in its entry on torture, said, the whole substance is one of only historical interest as far as Europe is concerned. The Dachau concentration camp was opened in March 1933. And that's another point that really grates about Mr. Obama's foreign policy, this view, very Marxist view of history, and this idea that history has a direction and mankind is just progressing all the time. Now, these flaws that Will points out in this article, they don't explain all of the flaws in this foreign policy. There's more, I think, to Mr. Obama's support of the Iran deal, as others have talked about on this program in months and years before. But those fundamental flaws are at the heart of so many mistakes that leaders, that and thinkers make on this subject of international relations, and it all gets back to a flawed understanding of human nature, something that the Bible clearly reveals. So I wanted to bring that article to you that I saw this morning. I thought it was just an excellent commentary on international relations. But to get back to the main thrust of what I want to talk about on this show, when I was last on Thursday, in kind of the few minutes before, while we were in the studio listening to the news, I was making fun of our producer, Sam Livingston, because he wrote up a news update about the Consumer Electronics Show going on right now in Las Vegas. Well, today is where he gets the last laugh, because now I'm going to give a whole Trumpet Daily Radio segment on that, or at least tied to that. So those of you who aren't tech-obsessed millennials, here's a quick update of what the Consumer Electronics Show is.
Today is the first official day of the 2017 Consumer Electronics Show. That's the biggest tech show of the year. And joining me now from the CNET booth in Las Vegas is Vanessa Han-Oriana. Thank you for joining us, Vanessa.
No problem. Good morning, Rena. You're right. The doors just opened about an hour ago here at CES, but we've at CNET already had some time to scope out the new trends. We've been here for 2 days, so I can kind of give you a brief rundown of what really stands out here at the show. Some of the trends we're seeing is just an evolution of a lot of the same products. A lot of TVs, gaming laptops, more drones, the automated cars, and the hubs for the home. And one of the standout drones, for example, was this selfie drone. I don't know if you've seen it quite yet, but it follows you around. It's the Hover Camera Passport.
Oh, look at that. Very interesting. And what does it do? It takes selfies, huh?
Yeah. So it's this personal drone that follows you around. You don't need a photographer anymore. It follows you around and it can sense, so it won't run into you. The other thing, the cool thing is the blades are covered, so no, nothing will happen if it hits you by mistake, but it also folds into almost like a book. So we're seeing kind of the evolution of the selfie. We haven't seen the end of it yet, and worst case, you can always control it with your phone. It does cost $600, so it's not going to be for everybody, but it's kind of cool to see how small the drones are getting these days.
So that's a quick intro to the Consumer Electronics Show, along with I thought that was a good intro to start with, describing a very expensive and quite ridiculous piece of tech, the selfie drone, for anyone desperate to get the perfect picture of themselves. For more of an overview of the kind of thing that was on display at this year's Consumer Electronics Show, rather than just pocketbook-sized drones that you can carry around to fly around and take pictures of yourself at any opportunity, here's just another clip overviewing some of the things there.
From your hairbrush to your shower to your car, the technology at this year's Consumer Electronics Show aims to make things around your home smarter. And instead of using just your hands to control them, you're using your voice.
These are all about speakers connected in your home, like the Amazon Alexa, the Google Home, Siri integrations through HomeKit, so you can ask Siri to change the temperature and do all kinds of cool stuff like that.
Brighter, sharper televisions are a big attraction, and this year, there's a bit of a twist.
We're going to see a lot of flexible screens, a lot of big curved displays on laptops.
Car makers have an even bigger presence at this CES as they show off concept cars, self-driving technology, and greater connectivity with your home.
We're going to see a lot about self-driving cars. We're seeing a lot about new ways of manufacturing cars and new ways in which cars actually talk to your house. So really exciting field here is what happens when you're in your car and your car can communicate with the rest of your life.
Wearables are moving beyond smartwatches and fitness trackers. Now you can monitor contractions, help grow more hair, or control your music.
So we start to think about wearables not just as something that you put on your wrist or your lapel, but as the sensors that are integrated into your life all the way across the board from your car to your bedroom.
So there's plenty to make fun of here. As I said, the selfie passport drone. There's a $10,000 poster thinness TV that you can stick to your wall, fridges that you can tweet from, for anyone that feels compelled to tell the world about some new life form they've just discovered the back of the fridge, bins or trash cans for our American audience that respond to voice commands. You can tell them when to open and close, smart hairbrushes, smart toothbrushes. I I don't see the smart dustbin catching on, but maybe. But those are the headline items at things like the Consumer Electronics Show. They tend to be the gimmicky products that kind of look ridiculous to get people reading the articles. But there are some serious trends and some serious implications here. Some of those things that are on display at the CES are genuinely crazy. Some just seem crazy. But remember, on this subject, you know, it was the president of IBM who back in the 40s said, I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers. A contender for one of the most mistaken predictions in all of history. So some of these things that do stand out right now as ridiculous are going to change the world. Now, the Trumpet Daily Radio, this isn't a tech show. We talk about the news and the events of the future that's going to affect your life. So why am I talking about this tech expo? Well, there are some important trends here that will really affect your life. There has been historically a close tie between technological revolution and social revolution. It can be summed up in the title that I've chosen for today. Is Siri going to steal your job? Or will Siri steal your job? Siri, on my iPhone, just sitting beside me, heard her name being mentioned and just popped up. Actually, English Siri is a him, but I've still gotten used to calling her. Not that I actually use Siri all that much. But this is something that's going to have an impact on world events. As tech gets smarter, this is something, an argument we see more and more in the press, that as tech gets smarter, it's going to take people's jobs, take more and more high-paying jobs, leaving us much poorer. Now, even though this is a subject that's been, that kind of thinking has been, and sentiment has been getting more and more column inches, it's something I've ignored, generally, for a couple of reasons. One is I tend to be a tech enthusiast, so I tend to automatically resist any ideas that say all this cool new tech is going to make the world a worse place. The other thing is there are some very ignorant arguments for this. A lot of these arguments tend to come from people on the left saying things along the lines of, well, more and more people's jobs are going to be replaced by robots. Therefore, we need big government to come in and fix the problem. And like most arguments from the left, it's misinformed and wrong on a great many levels. And I think to understand how some of this technology is going to impact world events, how it can play into social unrest, there are some myths that we need to clear up first. And one is that in all of history, there is never any example of a general rise in unemployment because of new technology. Whenever you see anybody arguing, and some people are, but whenever they argue that a trend that we're seeing is absolutely unique, that it's completely divorced from history and that the historical parallels aren't of any use in understanding it, they're almost always wrong. And this is especially in economics and economic trends. Back when I first studied economics in high school, it was kind of in the wake of the dot-com bust, where this time it's different was pretty much the catchphrase of the dot-com bust. People were saying, well, all the normal rules that would say we're in a bubble, that there's going to be a bust, that we're going to lose a lot of money, well, that doesn't apply because this, and this reason. And the reason sounded plausible. It was things like, okay, well, a company now doesn't need to own a lot of real estate because they can work on the internet. Therefore, these companies aren't overpriced the way that you would normally think so. And they did sound plausible, and they turned out to be wrong. So whenever anybody's saying this time it's different, this time we're going to see a trend completely divorced from history, that always sets alarm bells ringing. But what do I mean when I say there's no example of new technology causing a general rise in unemployment? I mean, surely there are tons of examples of people's jobs being replaced by machines. We've seen many times where a machine, you know, takes over the job of a human, which is true. But whenever that has happened historically, humanity has just created more jobs. And often the same technology that destroyed jobs creates far more jobs than it destroys. The left often kind of has this fallacy where there are X number of jobs available and robots or immigrants or whatever takes away from that somehow kind of magically predetermined total number of jobs. But that's not how jobs and how the economy works. A couple of examples to illustrate this and explain what I'm talking about. So, for example, in the 19th century, new technology came along and made it much easier to make cloth. I think this example came from an article in The Economist. But did this lead to mass unemployment of thousands of weavers? Not at all. And actually, it led to a dramatic increase in employment of weavers. A technology that took away weavers' jobs led to there being vastly more weavers. How did that happen? Well, the amount of labor needed per yard of cloth fell by 98%, but this made cloth so much cheaper, so people bought much more of it, so much more cloth was now being made. And then people needed more weavers to take this cloth and to turn it into things like clothes, something that hadn't been automated as much at that point. And so instead of weavers being replaced by these new machines, from 1830 to 1900, the number of weavers in America quadrupled. A more recent and perhaps better known example is ATMs. Bank machines, automatic teller machines, often known as ATM machines, which of course would then just make them automatic or teller machine machines. But machines that can replace a bank teller, that can pay in money in some cases, some of the newer ones, or withdraw money from your account. No longer would you have to talk to a human at a bank to do that. So did this mean that thousands of these machines replaced humans? No. That was not the overall effect. Instead, as ATMs were introduced, the number of bank tellers increased from 500,000 in 1980 to 550,000 in 2010. How did that happen? Well, ATMs made it cheaper to run and operate bank branches, and so banks opened more branches in more remote areas, creating more jobs. So instead of being worried about the rise of ATMs, instead it led to more bank jobs and banks in more locations, so benefits for consumers as well. Now, there are certainly examples of technology destroying jobs and that have not been so clearly beneficial as that example. However, they've always still, in general, the same rise in level of technology always ends up creating more than it destroys in other areas. So, for example, in 1900, the percentage of U.S. workers in agriculture was 41%. In 2000, it was 2%. Huge technological revolution in agriculture. But at the same time, it's just seen a massive rise in new jobs. You know, there were zero computer engineers in 1900. And there are a lot more now. You had cars. Cars dramatically reduced the demand for blacksmiths, for stable hands, for people looking after horses and making horseshoes, etc. But at the same time, cars created a whole load more jobs in manufacturing and making cars. So that's what I mean when I say there's no example in history of a general rise in unemployment because of a new technology. And this idea of technology destroying jobs is not new. In 1930, John Maynard Keynes warned of what he called a new disease, technological unemployment. And he said this was unemployment due to our discovery of means of economizing the use of labor, outrunning the pace at which we can find new uses of labor. And on this, like so much else, the high priest of modern economic theory was wrong. There has been no examples of this technological unemployment found. So that's why I tend to be skeptical as I saw more and more articles talking about how robots are going to destroy jobs, robots are going to take your jobs. And personally, in the long run, I don't think on net they will. But there is something important that this kind of long-term view overlooks. They may not destroy jobs overall in the long term, but this new technology certainly will disrupt jobs. And in the short term, that can have huge impacts. One pamphlet I've quoted a few times on this program is The Love of One's Own and Importance of Place by George Friedman. And it really is a great foundational essay on the subject of international relations. And in that essay, this is a kind of a side point to the one we normally emphasize when going through that. He addresses this idea. And he basically says, well, imagine there's some kind of development that would improve America's economy dramatically in the long run, in, say, 30 years' time, but would make everybody that works in the electronics industry unemployed. And he writes, from the standpoint of society as a whole, it might be a good idea. However, look at it from the standpoint of a 30-year-old American computer engineer with a child. Those 30 years would cover his productive life. He would not be able to practice his chosen profession, and also the massive investment in his education would not pay off. Between the ages of 30 and 60, when the social payoff should come, he would live a life quite different from the one he hoped for and would be in all likelihood substantially less comfortable. And so Friedman writes, societies and people run on different clocks. A society counts in terms of generations and centuries. A man counts in terms of years and decades. What constitutes a mere passing phase in American history in a small segment of the economy constitutes for that individual the bulk of his life. This is the fundamental tension between a nation and an individual. Nations operate on a different clock than individuals. Under most circumstances when the individuals affected are few and disorganized, the nation grinds down the individual. In those cases where the individual understands that his children might make a significant leap forward, the individual might acquiesce. But when the affected individuals form a substantial block, and when even the doubling of an economy might not make a significant difference in happiness of children, they might well resist it. And that, I think, is the situation we are heading for now. There's the potential for massive disruption for a lot of the technologies. We'll get into some of the specifics in a minute, but massive disruption from the technologies that were on display in the Consumer Electronics Show that could feed through to massive economic rest, many more strikes of the likes that we were talking about right at the start of the program. In London, economic unrest has tended to fuel political unrest, and we've already got political unrest. It can just, and I think economy is bears a major role in that already, but that will only increase as these technologies in the short term disrupt a whole lot of jobs and could potentially make millions unemployed. And as I said, in the longer run, fine, they may well create millions more jobs, but the extra jobs are not going to be necessarily filled by the ones that are unemployed. And in the shorter term, there's still the potential for those millions to create a lot of disruption. As Friedman says, society and individuals run on different clocks. So let's look at just one example of how some of these technologies on display in the Consumer Electronics Forum could be changed. Let's look at self-driving cars, something that we heard mentioned as being one of the big things on display there. Just about every car manufacturer is working on self-driving cars. And it's easy to overlook how much this will change society. I've seen a lot of headlines on this. I think Drudge especially seems obsessed with self-driving cars and takes great delight in splashing whenever there's even the minorest of fender benders, splashing that all over his website. But the vast majority don't consider just how far the implications of this fairly simple and, not quite mundane, but fairly simple sounding change go. So technology is rapidly accelerating to the point where cars can drive themselves better than humans can. And some of the more obvious consequences are things like reduced congestion, because computers can respond faster than humans, especially when they can be networked together. So you could have cars driving much closer together at high speeds. But then the implications go way beyond that. So if you have driverless cars that can park themselves, for example, so once this technology is fully mature and you can get out of your car and leave it to go and park itself, well, what does that mean for cities? It means no more prime real estate being taken up by multi-story car parks for these big concrete, ugly monoliths. Instead, you get out, the car goes away to some out-of-town parking lot just 5 minutes down the road, parks itself, comes back when you need it. So changing the face of cities. But then let's take this a step further. Why are taxis expensive? Why do we take a car rather than a taxi? Well, mostly you have to pay for the person driving the taxi. Our driverless cars means driverless taxis. It means that the cost of taking a taxi falls dramatically, even to the point that it means very almost certainly it would be cheaper to use taxis than it would be to own your own car. And so you see the entire model of car ownership shifting to one where you own a car and use it, to one where you have some kind of service and you use a car when you need it. And there'll be different types of services depending on how much you want to pay, perhaps with different wait times. There'll probably be some cheaper services that use more carpooling. There'll probably be different charges for different times of day. But it seems very probable with self-driving cars, you would shift away from car ownership. And so now what happens? Well, just on space, you don't need a driveway at home anymore. You don't need a garage. And in the UK, we're pretty cramped for space. Suddenly, that's a whole bunch of space freed up. It starts to transform the way our cities look. But then it gets even more disruptive. So 96% of the time, the average car is not being used. So if we switch to a model from everyone owns their own car to one where we all rent driverless cars in general on demand, well, suddenly the total number of cars that we need slumps. Now, you'll need spare capacity. We'll need enough cars to have at peak times. But I think it would be a reasonable estimate with this kind of a model that you could see at least a halving of the number of cars needed by society as a whole. That seems like a reasonable estimate. I haven't had time to look and see if anyone's done any work more exact, though I know experts have certainly talked about this. So if you halve the number of cars that are in need, and potentially even more, well, what effect does that have? And could well be even more, because one of the other implications here is, well, why don't people take the train and things like that more? Because the train has a high cost per journey, whereas the car has a much lower cost per journey, but a higher overall, you know, annual cost, say, or the cost of owning the car. And that starts to change when you switch to a renting model. The train becomes something that could be more competitive, maybe useful, may actually make more economic sense for longer journeys. So you have shifts there, again, potentially decreasing the need for cars, and then it's much easier to go to a station rather than having to go and park and pay however much for parking. But anyway, what kind of effect then does that have on the auto industry if suddenly the number of cars in use in developed world halves? Well, for auto manufacturing, that's cataclysmic. You know, even a 10% drop or a 1% or 2% drop can have major impacts on job. A half, you're talking about massive job losses. And these, again, I think here we're still dealing with the obvious effect. People are talking about the major impacts this is going to have on healthcare. And some of these impacts are absolutely fantastic. There are a million traffic deaths each year. Driverless cars could probably shrink that not just a little, but by several orders of magnitude, you know, 90%, 95% or more. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of lives saved each year if this is rolled out nationwide. You have 2 million sent to emergency rooms in the United States alone each year due to traffic accidents. So again, get rid of that. And that's a fantastic thing for so many people. But that also has huge economic implications. 2 million fewer ER visits. And then people are also talking about how it will completely upend the elderly care industry. And again, I think this is something that is a huge benefit, but also something that, I don't know, that people in this healthcare industry are talking about and thinking about in the future. So with self-driving cars, elderly people will be able to live independently at home for longer. And in this day and age, unfortunately, when people can no longer live independently at home, they tend to be put in a care home. But self-driving cars will enable them to live independently at home for much longer. And so, again, that's great, but it's causing a lot of uncertainty for planning down the line for this segment of the healthcare industry. And then you'll probably also see driving become more of a hobby, probably an explosion in kind of private racetracks and arrangements that would make it much cheaper for people to use that kind of thing. So this is a revolution in just one fairly simply articulated technology that leads to a revolution in so many things. And this isn't necessarily the scenario that I described. It isn't necessarily going to happen. But the obstacles to what I described, they are not technological. They're political. But the technology to do that, I may well be here already, but it's certainly getting developed quickly. And I think in the long run, so much of this sounds great. It has the potential to save a huge amount of space, a huge amount of money. But there are huge losers here as well, people who would lose out dramatically from this. So there are 250,000 taxi drivers in the United States. Self-driving cars directly affect them. Then in the US, there are 4 million that work in industries directly related to the car industry. So that's manufacture, but also then the sale of cars and the sale of parts. And if car sales suddenly, if people no longer, and if we shift away from car ownership model to a more of a car rental or timeshare type model, suddenly those jobs change dramatically or disappear. So I don't think it's unreasonable to say maybe 3 million out of that 4 million jobs going potentially. Now, in the long term, I don't think there'll be a huge change in unemployment. This I think driverless cars has the potential to mean that the cost of transportation will fall dramatically. And so those of us that don't work in the automotive industry will probably have more disposable income. Because of that, after housing, transportation is a very large part of every family's budget. And so seeing that cost decrease a lot substantially is going to have an impact on just about every family. And then they'll be spending more on other things, creating other jobs. But that's still a longer term effect. And the people that used to make or sell or drive taxis, you know, they're not going to necessarily be able to do these jobs, or it will be hard to train for them. And that's just one industry. You know, the idea of this program came from my dad, who works in IT consultancy. So he's kind of on the front lines of companies trying to plan for the future of technology and a lot of these different things that are happening. And the same kind of intelligent computers and machine learning, artificial intelligence that have made driverless cars possible, it's poised to affect a whole load of other industries. You may have heard of Amazon's Alexa. That was something that featured quite heavily at the Consumer Electronics Show, a voice-activated computer that surprised even Amazon with how well it sold. It's just something that hears and answers questions. That kind of thing is something that's becoming much smarter and something where the programming is available to much more people. And this is something that is kind of easy to ignore because Siri is a bit of a joke. Sorry, Apple fans. But this kind of technology is getting a lot better to the point that it's actually becoming useful. I think by all accounts, Alexa is very useful. The Google app with its OK Google surprises me often at how good it is at just answering questions, even to the point that sometimes I'll turn to it in international relations class if someone has a question on a specific that I don't know the answer to, and Google will often give it. So this is a field that is really progressing. And then you add to that artificial intelligence along with this vocal processing, you get to something that has a lot of potential. You're seeing something called speech synthesis markup language is becoming increasingly standard. I think Alexa runs off that for voice applications, and that's kind of the voice equivalent of hypertext markup language, or HTML, the language that is used to control how web pages are displayed. And then both Amazon and IBM are opening, and I think Microsoft maybe as well, I didn't check that, but they're opening up access to their kind of natural language processing in the cloud to make this kind of technology available just to ordinary people who are developers and working on subjects, and to have a look at just some of where this is going already. And again, it's the Consumer Electronics Show. It's kind of more of the gimmicky kind of applications that are on display. But here's another clip of where this is, the direction this is heading in.
But if you had to pick one trend that you're seeing over and over again at CES, what would it be this year?
That's what my wood shop is all about.
You know, the biggest trend is the home assistant. We've heard about the Amazon Alexa, this home assistant that helps you, you know, that has voice command and can handle orders and can control your other smart appliances around the home. Now we're seeing Alexa integrated into other devices, including cars, and including other devices geared for kids, actually. Mattel just released its new Aristotle, which is a type of home hub like Alexa. In fact, it does have Alexa incorporated, but it's actually geared for infants. So, for example, if your infant is crying, it knows to play it a lullaby. So it's Alexa, but with a much deeper learning and a specific task. Also, LG has some cute little robots that kind of give Alexa a personality and a shape now. So they have Alexa included. They can handle the same tasks, but they can also have facial recognition to recognize everybody in your family. So it's this evolution of Alexa, Amazon's Alexa, and what the home assistant will be capable of.
Now, I have to confess, enthusiastic as I may be for new technology, I don't really understand the Alexa craze or why that has proven so popular. But it certainly has, and now they're bringing out more and more of this to the point that you've got it with the car. I think we're not at all far away from the time where, say, your fridge may send a message to your car. This is something I remember reading about as a teen, but which could be seeing very soon, where your fridge sends a message to your car And so just as you're getting close to your supermarket, Alexa, or in your car, or whoever, Siri or whoever, says, hey, we're 5 minutes away from a supermarket. Fridge has just told me we're out of milk. Do you want to stop by and pick something up? But we're seeing a time where it's becoming increasingly easy and common for people to write these voice response programs as it is smartphones apps. And so soon you'll have, or as easy to write these kind of voice response programs as it is to write smartphone apps. And so soon you'll have hundreds of thousands of people working on programs to do this kind of thing. So it's something that's going to become much more common. You'll start to see it coming into the business world. There'll be these kind of digital assistants will start taking over from real life assistants, doing things like finding you the cheapest rail or plane ticket to a destination, researching certain things, finding the best price to buy something is probably an easier area for them to start to get into. But more and more of the functions that have generally been done by secretaries or assistants. And there's even talk about these affecting journalism. People are experimenting with having robots write stories, or more commonly, robots put together kind of a draft or compile the facts into something that is kind of story-ish. And then having the human come in and kind of put on the creative touches on top of that with an intro and just other things in there and organizing it. I think you'll certainly see more and more of it getting involved in research and seeing computers use more and more and these kind of assistants to go and compile research, maybe even highlight things, kind of like what I do in the mornings for Mr. Flurry, and go and find some of the best, the news that it thinks is going to interest you, or the relevant background information and highlight and link various different things together. Call centers is one area that people I think will be heavily disrupted here. I would guesstimate that about 80% of questions that even like tech support, call centers and things like that guesses are really simple and could be handled by machines. And then, you'll get machines that are becoming smarter and smarter, much easier to talk to and taking more of the load. More and more things are already shifting, or companies are already shifting to online chat. My internet was broken for over a month. I ended up having to leave the company because they just couldn't fix it. But I used the chat a lot then because it was easier to do that than sit on hold for 45 minutes. And so soon, our companies already are starting to feed these chat logs that they've got from their interactions to companies into machine learning programs, which then learn from all of the past interactions. And so very soon, when you chat, you won't know whether you're talking to a human or to a bot on one of these chat type call centers. And if it's simple, the robot will answer your question and you'll never know that you were talking to a robot. And if it's more complicated, they'll know to seamlessly pass you over to a human. And even take what we do here with our call center and at headquarters. I don't envision us ever doing it. I don't think that's really the way that we would want to conduct things, but probably about 95, maybe even 99, a good number of our calls could quite easily be handled by machines. We tend to answer the phone. People say what booklet they want us to send them. We put it on order for them. And that kind of thing is going to become increasingly automated. Another major technology we've not really mentioned so far that people are looking to as being very disruptive is 3D printing. How does that affect global manufacturing? If, say, an auto shop no longer needs to order in car parts, but just instead has one probably quite expensive 3D printer and then schematics from all the manufacturers and just prints what they need on demand. Or in some annoying piece of plastic breaks on something that you've got and you want to fix it, instead of having to go and spend $50 from the company that manufactured it to buy a piece of plastic that's worth 50p, instead you may be able to send the blueprint to a 3D manufacturer and he'll print it to you and give it to you for $5 instead. How does things like Bitcoin even revolutionize banking and then even potentially real estate and the legal profession? And we've just kind of quickly mentioned a few different technologies and voice technology. We've not bottomed them out in the same way that we did self-driving cars. But every single one of these, when you kind of drill down and look at the knock-on effects and the knock-on effects of those knock-on effects, these are things that have the potential to be very, very disruptive and have the potential to create a lot of unemployment. As I say, in the long term, they may well turn out to be net goods, but there's a lot of disruption in the short term from what the trends that we're seeing in things like that Consumer Electronics Show. And even a lot of the implications, probably the biggest implications of so many of these things, nobody has foreseen yet. That's the way it's been with so much of technology. The biggest applications of it have kind of emerged later. So my point is this. We're on the cusp of more intelligent technology really revolutionizing lives and society. Big changes, even to things like the way our cities look, the way our roads look. And typically, personally, being kind of a fan of technology and gadgets, I've kind of looked at this as an unmitigated good. And there are a lot of things to like about it. But especially in the short term, there are definitely going to be people that lose out. A lot of people. Even if it's a net overall good, there are still going to be millions, potentially, or individual segments of society that lose out. And we live already in a world struggling with massive social unrest, where upstart parties with policies that used to be unthinkable are taking over Europe, where people are rising up against the established order, where we already see economic instability leading to political instability, leading to global instability. And so these technological changes, they certainly have the potential to lead to huge economic instability for a lot of people, for millions of people. And they're happening and can happen far faster than we tend to think. I remember in the last year or two of high school reading a book called When Things Start to Think. And it talked about things like a computer that's just as powerful as the computers of the day that you carry around in your pocket. It talked about things like, I think it may have even used the term electronic ink, to display text that doesn't need a backlight and just kind of looks passive, just like paper, and has then very, very long battery life. And those kind of things then looked futuristic. And that, I think the iPhone and the Kindle just came out a couple of years after I read that book. And they seemed so, those things then seemed so far in the future. Now they're normal or old. So these things change very fast. And that's something that's different from in times in the past where we've seen major changes in technology affecting society. It's happening at a much quicker pace. I mean, just to look at how we've seen some of this happen before, here's a couple of quotes from the Encyclopedia Britannica on the Industrial Revolution. And they write that during the decades of economic and social transformation, Western Europe also experienced massive political change. The central event throughout much of the continent was the French Revolution and its aftermath. This was followed by a concerted effort at political reaction and renewed series of revolutions from 1820 through to 1848. Connections between political change and socioeconomic upheaval were real but complex. Economic grievances associated with early industrialization fed into later revolutions, particularly the outburst in 1848. But the newer social classes were not prime bearers of the revolutionary message. Revolutions also resulted from new political ideas. Anyway, I think it makes a good point. It's not simple to say, well, industrial revolution directly caused these political revolutions and was the sole cause of them. You know, that's not true at all. But the economic changes of the Industrial Revolution were a major factor involved in those just wave of revolutions we saw across Europe in the 19th century. And today, technology could well be a major factor in the growing social unrest that we're seeing. Again, not the only cause, perhaps not even the root cause or the most important cause, but something that is there accelerating and accentuating the problems. And as I said, this tech revolution, while it may not be as big as the Industrial Revolution, but it is happening faster. It takes quite a long time to cover a country with railways. It doesn't take long to sell a few hundred thousand voice-activated computers. So these changes that we saw back then that were gradual and therefore kind of easier to digest could well be hitting all at once. Now, there was another aspect that I had some notes on that I have to skip over, I think, but also is just that the way that generally technological revolutions have fed into political revolutions in the way that they democratize power. You go back thousands of years ago and ordinary people were generally powerless. And a lot of power is concentrated within the aristocracy, whereas things like the printing press and the telegraph, by spreading education, also enabled a spreading of power to the point that ordinary people could play a much greater role in politics, which plays in more easily to unrest. That's just a very, very quick skip over of what I had noted down there. And people are already talking about technology playing a role in that regard, with the Arab Spring and the way that it's much easier for news to spread without the control of governments, in exactly the same way the telegraph started to allow to happen with the revolutions of 1848. And that could well have an impact on social unrest. And I think it already is having an impact in the ease of people being able to get like-minded people together and organize protests within the United States and to get groups of people to travel to a particular spot. So the technology does play a role in world events. And even something like that consumer electronic show in Las Vegas can have its role in world events and in Bible prophecy, because this is a subject that is of huge prophetic significance. The rise in social unrest, it impacts a lot of things. We've been talking about this with in the United States, the threat of just a breakdown of law and order. Here's what Mr. Flurry said about this on a recent Key of David program.
Also, people are fully aware that these riots and this violence could spread like wildfire to other cities. Baltimore is only about 40 miles north of Washington, D.C., which could easily erupt into serious riots at any time. But did you know that these burning cities were actually prophesied in your Bible? That it is prophecy in your Bible. Isaiah 1 and verse 7 states that your cities are burned with fire. Does that prophecy have anything to do with us today? Well, you can prove that it does. God tells us in Isaiah chapter 1 why we have these violent protests and the burning of the cities. And he also tells us how to solve that problem. And I think we ought to be very much interested in that. How do you solve that problem?
That's from a Key of David. I think it was given for the summer of 2015, but it's still something that's very current. The cover article for Mr. Flurry's article in the January Trumpet print edition of The Trumpet is called America's Coming Civil War. We're also watching Europe, the rise of radical movements and far-right movements there. And so we're seeing, and again, this is something that could really feed into that. We're already seeing how things like the Greek crisis and the massive unemployment in southern Europe have helped feed into the economic crises that we're seeing there. And it's quite easy to see how something like this could lead to problems in individual locations, maybe areas that really rely on certain industries as that industry gets hit. So this is something that can feed into the economic, the political upheaval that we've seen in Europe. As he said, economic unrest so often leads to political unrest, political destabilization, which can lead to global destabilization. So that's about it from me today. Mr. Flurry should hopefully be back if he makes it out of London. I'm sure he will, to host the program tomorrow. If you have any questions or comments, please do email us at td@kpcg.fm. And tune in tomorrow for Mr. Flurry's return, and just keep listening.